Welcome to our two-part report called Sex Trafficking, Breaking Free from the New Slavery. We've put together two shows, 1 hour about men, and this hour is about women. Here's your host, Chantel Sings.
A lot of people think the sex trade has always been with us and always will be. But when it infects our families and communities, we are bound to call it out for what it is. Brutal, exploitive, and self-destructive. Sex trafficking is a moving target, by definition, a hidden crime. Still, there are ways to draw a safety net around victims and survivors and protect vulnerable people, especially children. The more we talk about the problem, the less traffickers will be able to hide. And we're going to speak frankly this hour. Sex trafficking is not what's portrayed in the movie Taken. It's not rich white teenagers abducted by foreign gangs, though there may have been isolated incidents like that. The coming hour is a follow-up to a report we aired a year ago. In that hour, we learned how most victims and many of their traffickers live in low-income neighborhoods. Sex buyers come from across the Twin Cities and Minnesota, but typically don't come from the same neighborhoods as the victims. Sex trafficking is a problem that has particular impact in the Native community and in African American neighborhoods, according to data collected by the state and other researchers. This hour, we're going to talk about why it hits our communities the hardest. We're going to meet women who are doing something about it. Many of those women speak from their own experience being trafficked.
My name is Tina Sani. I am 2 years and 3 months a survivor.
Tina Sani is 26 years old. She has light green hair and dark eyes. With her complexion, she could be any ethnicity. She never knew her dad and most of her life thought he was Hispanic, but a DNA test told her he must have been black. Anyway, we meet Tina at a house on University Avenue in St. Paul. It's the headquarters of Breaking Free, a survivor-led nonprofit that's been around since the 90s. It helps women in the life get out of the life. Tina has stopped by to get help filing for health insurance.
Breaking Free defines prostitution as paid rape, modern-day slavery, and violence against women.
Tina is learning to understand what happened to her through a 14-week class at Breaking Free. It's called Sisters of Survival.
Each module is a little bit different. We just kind of dive a little bit deeper into, what human trafficking is, what exploitation is.
Besides the Sisters of Survival class, Breaking Free helps women with court cases, child care, and housing. Most of all, it offers a community where women feel comfortable and supported. Tina's just getting to know the other women at Breaking Free.
I'm trying to find somebody that'll hire me for something I actually like to do.
I own my own salon. It's really hard.
Do you rent space? Really
hard. I rent a studio.
Okay.
It's really hard. It's
where?
Like
those bills
in Maplewood.
Keep coming.
They don't stop. I pay every week.
Sometimes I wish that I could just do it like monthly, but I think I want to have a job that like fulfills me. Like I love, like don't get me wrong, I love my studio, but that thing does not make me money. Like I cannot pay my bills with that.
It's a lot of overhead.
No,
all your products.
Tina is 100% sure she's out of the life for good. She understands the financial pressures that make it tempting to dip back in. And she's learning more about what made her vulnerable in the first place. She says she checked all the boxes. She'd been abused as a little girl and always kept it a secret. Her mom was addicted to drugs and unable to raise her. The grandma she stayed with died when Tina was 10, and after that, she moved around. She was 18 and homeless when her trafficker found her.
What a lot of people don't realize is there's a literal book that pimps will read that tells them all about how to mentally manipulate women into the life.
Tina says she knows about the book because her trafficker owned it.
They find those vulnerabilities. And I obviously had many. I had abandonment issues, daddy issues, like all of the issues.
But what if someone had found her before her trafficker did? What if she'd been offered services and intervention when she was still a teenager? That's the idea behind Minnesota's Safe Harbor Law. Safe Harbor says youth who engage in prostitution are victims and survivors, not criminals. Wherever they appear, it could be the legal system or child welfare or through mandatory reporters like teachers and social workers, they get help, not jail time. One of the places where they can get that help is the Minneapolis YMCA.
We are going to start off the session with some reflective writing.
This is Jenny Miller, an executive with Youth Intervention Services at the Y. We're in a community room in Northeast Minneapolis. Half a dozen teenage girls are here. Some of them are accompanied by life coaches, social workers assigned to help them overcome whatever challenges landed them in the system. This is the last night of the program, and so Jenny Miller is asking them to work on some really hard questions.
So why are words powerful? The center table is going to be, how can someone recognize their own vulnerability? And then the third table is going to be, what do you do when you identify vulnerability and risk for abuse and exploitation in your own life? So the definitions of the words are up on the wall, like you know they are every week.
Jenny is following a curriculum designed specifically for youth who have been sex trafficked.
Take out a pen. You're not sharing this with anybody. It's for you. Just do some reflective writing on those three questions, okay? They are very deep questions, but these are really intelligent young people. Yeah. And we've been spending the last 5 weeks, so 5 weeks today, building on these concepts. So while for a new person walking in, it's, oh, wow, that's kind of intense, or those topics are triggering. These young ladies have been spending the last 5 weeks really diving into what those concepts mean to our community, to them as individuals, and to the people that they love and care about.
Jenny says the point is to give these young women specific tools to keep themselves safe.
The next activity we're going to do is a what would you do scenario. And so I'm going to give you each a card. One's going to be personal and one's going to be peer. The blue one is personal. The gray one is peer.
The activities are based on these girls' real lives, but they ease into real life by reading mock scenarios like this one.
Your family has been struggling financially for a while. They are even having a hard time putting food on the table. That has brought a lot of stress on everyone. Most people around you don't know what you are going through. You are starting to worry that your family will go homeless very soon.
After the prompts, the young women think of real situations that they've been in and what they would do or could do.
We're just talking about what would we do, Jenny?
Yep. I know what I'll do.
What would you do, Crystal?
Get a job.
Get a job.
They brainstorm safety plans, learn about apps and resources, people they can always call for help. This young woman said that she would fight a guy who tried to lure her into his car.
So then I was ready to fight, so I'm like, okay, step out the car. We're going to box this out.
Right?
Yeah. He just ended up driving off.
Yeah. What so are then, the two resources that you gave at the bottom?
I said a life coach and the hotline.
Why?
A life coach because they would know what to do in a situation because I'm feeling pretty sure they trained for it. Yeah. And the hotline because if you call the hotline, they'll probably give you steps to get out of it.
Right, absolutely. And so do you think that the person driving that vehicle that she just described, if you look up at the word exploited, what do you think what he was trying to do to Crystal?
Probably trying to, you know, like, shelter her.
Or
like not be her pimp, but be like her sugar daddy, but like try to treat her like.
All the kids still wear backpacks.
Yeah, like.
And then that, your age, you just named it perfectly. Your age and your location are what two things? What are those two things called?
A pedophile?
Yes, she's a minor, you're right. But her age and her location being outside are two vulnerabilities, right?
Yes.
And so a person was taking advantage of those vulnerabilities.
The curriculum Jenny is teaching is called Not a Number. We'll hear more about how it works a little later in the program. For now, just know the goal is to help these young women by boosting their self-confidence and showing them where to find help if they need it.
So I just want to say that I might cry.
Oh. I know, here I go, my feelings.
But I have loved each and every one of you and have loved spending the last 5 weeks with you. I'm going to be so sad next Wednesday not to be kicking it with you guys. But I just so appreciate you opening up your hearts and taking a risk on coming to this group and hanging out with me, even when I swear a lot, even when I'm super sweaty or running around like crazy. You all are unique, beautiful individual souls, and I love you. So I am going to call up a name, and you come up here with your I am.
There's one final exercise the last night of the program. Jenny asks each girl to write a description of herself.
And I want you to say your name and to say I am, and you finish that statement.
As the girls come up, they get a framed certificate and a hug from Jenny. One girl brings her baby boy.
Zavi says, I am very loved.
I'm gonna cry.
And Maya says, I am not who I used to be.
The 5-week class is meant to get under their skin, to get them thinking differently about themselves and their circumstances. Jenny says it is also meant to disrupt the supply side of sex trafficking, to make sure fewer young people are vulnerable to predators. But the girls in Jenny's program have a lot of conflict and adversity in their lives. They're teenagers, after all, and many of them enter the life because they come from messed up homes. In Hennepin County, The Link is the first stop for many sex trafficking victims. If they're under 25, they get services instead of jail time thanks to Minnesota's Safe Harbor Law.
My name is Keisha Stewart, and I'm the Safe Harbor Division Director at The Link. And we don't use the P word, prostitute. Kids can't be prostitutes. A child can be prostituted by an exploiter, but a child cannot be a prostitute. It's something that happens to them. It's not who they are. Basically, you're asking a kid, what happened to you to get you here? As opposed to asking them, why are you doing this? Why are you like that? Two totally different approaches.
We are talking to Keisha at The Link's shelter in Prior Lake.
I can see vast differences in where we were in terms of the Safe Harbor movement in Minnesota and where we are now. Early on, we had to convince people that exploitation happens here in Minnesota. You know, we would talk about exploitation and people would refer to the movie Taken. You know, that's what they would think of. It doesn't happen here in the United States, let alone in my backyard. So it felt like an uphill battle initially because most people were oblivious to the fact that this goes on every single day in every city in Minnesota. You just may not know where. It's an underground movement by nature of the criminal aspect of it, but it's definitely happening. And as we provided various trainings in community agencies and schools and whoever was willing to listen, the more trainings we provide, the more trainings are requested, which means the word is getting out there.
Treating sex trafficked youth as victims instead of criminals, it's still a relatively new concept. The Safe Harbor program has been up and running only 5 years. In that time, service providers like Keisha have learned what works and what doesn't.
We need to create a system where kids can come and go because kids run. We are a shelter. And when kids run, you know, early on, we were thinking that's the worst thing that can happen. We're failures. We didn't meet the needs of that kid. We didn't save that kid's life. And there are also performance measurements that everyone has to have, right? If you contract with a county, if you contract with a business, what are the performance measures that you have to uphold? Well, for us, when we had a kid that was being referred to our program, and we saw that he or she ran from every program that they were in on the first day. If they stay with us for 2 weeks and then they run, could that not be considered a success? It's the way that we view the kids that we're serving. And what we have to do is take into consideration what life as a youth that has been exploited looks like.
Here at this shelter, youth can stay up to 90 days. They can go to school while they're here, see social workers and health professionals, and work on reunification with family. But it's not easy for the youth or for the service providers.
They may fight at first. They don't have to be your friends to deserve the help that we provide. They don't have to like you as an adult. They don't have to connect with you because for the most part, they should be leery. Someone along the way has tainted that innocence that they should have. Someone along the way has abused them. And so they should be leery of adults that they don't know, that they'll know for maybe 90 days and never see again. That's a survival skill that they've learned while they've been in the life, you know? And so we don't want to take that skill away from them. We just want to support them and let them see that you deserve this help. We're here to give it to you. If you can't get it from us, here are the other places you can go to get it.
Because Minnesota has identified sex trafficking as a public health problem, there are services available all over the state. A growing number of agencies and even private businesses are learning how to recognize the problem. Last year, we reported on a group called Truckers Against Trafficking, and there is new legislation that mandates training for people who work in hotels. Keisha says that's progress. But there's an immense demand for safe housing and for ongoing mental health services. Just ask the youth who have been there. That's what The Link does.
And now we have youth that are serving on committees to where they are now part of the solution. They are part of the solution. And as long as we listen to what they say and we find ways to partner with the people who have the resources, the people who make the decisions, we can keep the great work that's being done in Minnesota going.
The Youth Advisory Committee meets twice a month at The Link's office on the Near North Side.
They shouldn't say the word prostitute or sex worker because that is highly offensive. Very, very, very offensive.
We ask these young people what they want the community to know about their lives and challenges.
And when a worker, like, reads your file, because we have files, mm-hmm. but if a worker reads your file and just bases everything off your file, like, you're not trying to get to know me as a person. You're just trying to learn. You're looking at me like I'm a file, like mm-hmm. I'm a piece of paper.
And then on top of that, like, don't lock them up because mm-hmm. you don't know who's out here forcing them to do something. How are you going to, you know, lock somebody up? They don't think they can get out of it. They don't think there's another way. Like, it's a chain around the brain. And you put them in jail where it's actually a physical kind of lockup. What do you think you're doing? You're not helping. Great. They don't need to be locked up.
Lock up our traffickers.
Beth Holger convenes the meetings. She's executive director at The Link.
They help us as an agency to design our programs and hire and train our staff and evaluate ongoing our programs to make sure we're doing it right. But then they also have a much bigger impact because they help us change local policies, state policies, laws.
Their insights are a reality check on government officials and agency staff who may have good intentions but be clueless as to what life is like for trafficked teens. Members of the Youth Advisory Committee have testified with Holger. They've helped her train judges how to think about sex traffic. They even accompanied her to the White House during the Obama administration. Holger says they have helped a lot, and they continue to need a lot of help. One young woman says The Link is helping her through a rough patch right now.
If you ain't got nowhere to sleep, they will find you shelter. They will make sure you have a place to stay. They'll make sure you got clothes on your back and food in your stomach. I come here all the time. All the time, if I ain't in jail, I'm a second home.
Last year, Keisha Stewart left The Link to become a consultant, but she remains committed to giving trafficked youth both shelter and respect.
And what I'm noticing with these kids is that for so long they've been reduced to what they can provide someone else with their body and acts that they perform. But when you put them in situations where they're able to talk to political officials, where they're able to talk to leaders and executive directors and doctors and lawyers about their experience, what they needed and what they would like to see other kids have, how much more can you do to build the esteem of a youth who was told they would never amount to anything? We're showing them, and they're seeing themselves walk in a way that is healthy, is successful. Oftentimes these kids start to feel like, I can do it.
You're listening to Sex Trafficking, Breaking Free from the New Slavery. This hour is all about what women are doing to address the problem. Once again, here's your host, Chantel Sings.
It pops your eyes, too. I think, like, the golden tone, like, really goes with the blue in your eyes.
I think so.
Remember Tina Sani? She's the young woman we met at Breaking Free in St. Paul. She was attending the 14-week Sisters of Survival class, thinking about whether and where to move and how to pay her bills. She invited us on her journey, and so we caught up with her at her studio that she rents in Maplewood.
Monday and Tuesday, and then every other Sunday.
While Tina's story is still being written, it has a lot in common with other survivors. She said she didn't know her biological parents. She was raised by relatives, then friends. She did graduate high school and then got a cosmetology license. After that, she moved to Colorado with friends. She was 18. But it didn't work out. The friendship tanked, and then Tina got in trouble with the law.
I had only been in Colorado for 2 months before I went to jail for 6 weeks. I'm walking around trying to sell, trying to find a pawn shop to sell all of my nail stuff at. I hear a car honking at me, and I'm a very, like, curvy woman, so, like, I'm kind of used to things like that. So I didn't really look at first, but then he was, like, waving at me and, like, turned into the gas station on the other side of the street. He's just like, you know, let me help you, like, I'll take you to where you need to go. And then we didn't find any place. Nobody wanted my stuff, like, duh. And at the end of it, he was like, well, do you, like, should I take you home? And I was like, well, you could, but it's like a car in a parking lot. He's like, oh, you can't do that. And I started telling him, I was like, oh, it'll be fine. Like, I was going to just go to Colfax. I'm just going to go work the track. Like, I'll be fine. He's like, have you ever done this before? And I was like, no. And he was like, no, you can't do it like that. And so he's like, let me show you how to do it the right way.
Tina was broke, jobless, homeless, and hopeless. The guy who picked her up made her feel better, safer, at least for a while. He told her she was special, that she was his girlfriend, and he would take care of her. Eventually, he asked her to recruit other women. Then he made her their boss. For 3 years, he was in control of her life and her money. Though she's now been out of the life as long as she was in, that pimp is still in her business. He damaged her self-esteem, took her money, and ruined her credit rating.
Credit controls everything. Credit controls our lives as survivors. And almost all of us, I promise you, have messed up credit. It's just what your pimp or trafficker will do. They put everything in your name because they don't want anything in theirs. And then they can move on from you and get whatever they need. But you're screwed.
Tina says her credit is so bad, landlords won't rent to her. She pays more interest on her 20-year-old car than it's worth. She doesn't qualify for a payday loan. And like many survivors, she's fallen for credit card offers that come in the mail but have exorbitant interest rates. She can't get ahead.
So then you're like, well, screw it. Why am I even out here trying to do this square life when I could just literally go back into the game, have these freaking tricks just pay me for like an hour of my body and get over it? That's why we go back.
But Tina's not going back, even though she says she can't afford to get a regular job because debt collectors would garnish her wages. She relies on income from various hair and makeup gigs, including ones that come through the salon she shares. She's completed the Sisters of Survival class through Breaking Free and is now getting paid as part of its speakers bureau. She hosts a podcast about life after being sex trafficked. It's called Naming Jane Doe. And she's finding her voice as a motivational speaker, including for an international group called the Survivor Alliance.
My name is Christine Stark. I'm a writer, a visual artist, organizer. I've been doing this work for about 30 years. I'm also Anishinaabe, Cherokee, and white.
Though Chris Stark is a published author, athlete, and survivor, there is part of her that always remembers what she endured as a little girl.
I'm being raped in my home, and I'm being sold by family members. And pornography, and what we now call trafficking, since we don't say prostitution anymore.
I remember what it's like to be her, and I know that there are many thousands of women and children out there who are being abused, and it's time for this country to stand up and stop it.
Like so many other survivors, as she grew up and moved away, Chris buried her trauma in drugs and alcohol. When she got sober is when she started facing it.
You know, I grew up having to fight all the time. I had to fight my father all the time to just survive. So, you know, I immediately stepped into the political arena and into organizing, because that was about fighting for justice. And I knew that fight really, really well. And it was also an extension of my own, I guess we say healing now, but my own empowerment. I was really mad. I was really enraged that these things had happened to me, and I had this idea that I was going to step forward and tell other people about it, and then we were going to figure out how to make it so that nobody else would be hurt in these ways. And that wasn't exactly the experience that I've had over the past 30 years. People pretty much want you to be quiet.
Chris hasn't been quiet. In 2011, she was one of the authors of the Garden of Truth report, published by the Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition. The report was based on interviews with more than 100 Native women who had been prostituted. Most had been raped as children, most of them by caregivers. A vast majority abused drugs or alcohol, and almost all had been homeless. The Garden of Truth report did more than document what Native communities were experiencing. The report showed a direct link between sexual exploitation of Native women today and the history of colonial violence against Native nations.
One of the women from Garden of Truth said that one of the white Johns said to her, "I thought we killed all of you." One of the women that I spoke with in northern Minnesota, her pimp was a wealthy white businessman from a wealthy suburb. He would have her play Pocahontas and John with him. And so out of that system that targeted indigenous women and girls from the very get-go, you have a legacy of white mentality that indigenous women are prostitutes.
Chris Stark and the other Garden of Truth authors say that because sexual violence against Native women is directly connected to colonial violence, culturally specific healing is necessary. Chris says it was necessary for her.
When I came back here, I was just really readily accepted by the Anishinaabe community and brought back into the community. And that's been, the most profound healing and has brought more happiness to my life than I could have imagined. Obviously, no one can speak for every single Native person, but you have to have culturally appropriate services for Native people. Things that work for Native people are not necessarily going to show up under a white system of measurement, okay? So that, like, a sweat lodge is profoundly healing for Native people. It's a traditional cultural healing method. Where are the organizations going to find funding for that? If White Ways doesn't value that, and if the White Ways of measurement don't measure it as being healing.
Chris is glad that sex trafficking and prostitution are finally being recognized as public health problems that hurt the whole community. But she's wary of how the money flows and what she calls the professionalization of the field. She says lived experience should count as much or more than academic degrees.
Because prostituted women could end prostitution. Because when you survive something like that, you are very strong. And you know how it works. And you know what they do. And you know how they do it. And you have the passion and the knowledge and the strength and the experience to stop it.
The other thing we're going to do tonight is sing the Strong Woman song, and everybody's going to sing it. So just to psych you up for that one, everybody takes a turn.
Community solutions are already underway. At Elders Lodge on the east side of St. Paul, Chris Stark's friend, Eileen Houdon, runs a healing drum group for Native women.
So in our drum group, there are people who are homeless, there are people who work for the state, there are attorneys. They're all walks of life from our diverse community and a diversity of tribes as well.
Eileen Houdon has been an advocate for women since she left her own abusive marriage 40 years ago. She sees more and more Native women using the strength of the community.
The grandchildren in particular rely on the grandmas. And if the grandmas learn how to be advocates, then that grandchild or those friends, friends and relatives are going to confide in her and disclose and then maybe take legal action.
While community responses continue, Native people and allies are working to change policy at the state level. A new task force will study systemic causes behind the violence that Indigenous women and girls face. The task force will figure out the best way to collect data the state needs to start working on solutions. The bill that created this new task force was authored by a Native legislator, Mary Kunesh Poding. It was signed into law in May 2019.
Listening to Sex Trafficking, Breaking Free from the New Slavery. This hour is all about what women are doing to address the problem. Once again, here's your host, Chantel Sings.
So far this hour, we've learned about efforts to help women leave the life of commercial sexual exploitation. We've learned that Minnesota law offers services instead of jail time to young people who've been trafficked. Now we're going to learn about the move to crack down on the demand side of sex trafficking. This is Breaking Free's Demand Change event at the Union Depot, downtown St. Paul. Native drummers sing a healing song to a packed room at the end of a long day, a day that ended with a panel of Native survivors talking about missing and murdered Indigenous women. Breaking Free's Executive Director, Terry Forlitti, thanks the panel and the singers and acknowledges the Native community's ongoing pain.
Okay, I am a Christian woman, and I have to apologize for the way you have been treated. I am not going to apologize for the gospel, but I am going to apologize for the way that you've been treated. But we need to come together. We need to come together as a body of people that are changing. Good-hearted people, and people that know the truth, that will come together and walk beside our sisters and our brothers.
The Demand Change event features advocates, prosecutors, government officials, even men who used to buy sex. All people determined to end sex trafficking and help survivors. Tina Sani is here. She's the hair and makeup artist who's a relative newcomer at Breaking Free. She's sitting at a table in the back.
It's been absolutely incredible, honestly. I mean, we're just doing so many amazing, powerful things with the men breaking free and now showing up for the Indigenous and missing women. Like, this is something that needs to be talked about, and it's sad that it hasn't been. That's, I had no idea about most of that.
Now Tina is becoming an activist on behalf of survivors. She speaks on panels about her experience being trafficked. She made a mask that hangs in the traveling art exhibit that is part of the Demand Change event.
I made this one, my silver mask, and basically I was like, well, this is me, like, after. Like, this is what I am like after the life with, like, the light and my glittery self. So kind of depicted my after effect there.
In the spring, she went to Terry Forlitti, the head of Breaking Free, to a conference in Wisconsin.
I have the privilege to bring 9 of our survivors, many of which are here today, to the University of Wisconsin at Madison. And for many of them, this is the first time they've ever been in a hotel without having to have sex. All right. This is what we're talking about.
Terry and the people at this event are grateful that the public seems to be paying more attention to the problem. There is growing awareness that survivors need more support than what's available, especially with housing.
So this is a letter that came in from Shakopee Prison. So, dear Terry, hello. How are you doing? A few of us women were wondering how you're doing. How have you been? I'm doing okay. I'm 900 hours in on my cosmetology license hours. Life is so good for me right about now. I'm 9 months away from liberation. Yay. Just recently found out I am going to be a grand madre. I need your assistance. In order to find out how to maintain and secure the housing that is available for us women and alumni, I am so scared to fall into the old people, places, and things in Minneapolis. I'm in need of a good foundation, and I have no plans of being stuck within the system when I get out. I'm going to be off and working with a quickness. Please help. That's my cry out. That's what we do.
Terry and Breaking Free can't do it alone. They need the culture to change and funding for services like housing and mental health support. Meanwhile, some of the most lasting, effective, and authentic solutions rise directly from the community. Liberty Community Church in North Minneapolis is celebrating Palm Sunday with gospel readings, music, song, and dance. And that's just in the chapel. The church is a true community center with K through 12 school, support group meetings of all kinds, and an open, welcoming feel. Reverend Dr. Alika Galloway is co-pastor at Liberty.
When we go back within the Black church context, hope and faith and radical community engagement is the same. It is the same. And our hope and our faith gives us the tools and the power to engage actively in community engagement. It's justice work.
Part of Liberty's justice work is the weekly meetings it holds for survivors of sex trafficking. We visited one of those meetings in our program last year. Take a listen.
So this is the Tuesday gathering of women who are healers in need of healing. And in one way, all of us have been victims of sexual exploitation.
The women who gather here share stories and draw strength from each other.
I came in awareness of what was really happening, and I didn't block it. Mm-hmm. See, the miracle comes in, it don't hurt anymore because you're able to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And help somebody else through it. Mm-hmm. And then it becomes more empowering. Then you can see God was there for me. No matter what, I'm still here.
And that's why we say we are a group of healers in need of healing. Because all of us have stuff. I don't know a African-American female who is not the victim of sexual exploitation on one way or the other. Because we live in a community and in a society that practices a philosophy of hypersexuality with regard to Black female bodies.
That was a year ago. The women still meet Tuesdays at Liberty Community Church. But some of the ideas and hopes they brainstormed back then are moving forward. The main project they've been working on is called the Northside Healing Space. Northside Healing Space is an actual space in Old Church on 21st and Fremont on the North Side.
I don't know what's going to come out of this, but my job is not to control it. My job is to do it.
While Pastor Alika's group raises money for a Northside Healing Space, healing already goes on there.
Stretch your arms out. If they're not stretched out, stretch them out. Head goes up, up.
On the worn wooden floor of what was once a sanctuary, Kenna Cotman leads a drum and dance group called Voice of Culture. It's a celebration of Blackness and West African griot or storytelling culture. Hey. Everyone is welcome, though the dancers are mostly teenagers and young women. While youth play the drums, grandmas and babies watch, keeping time.
Hey, dance.
Some of the dancers are highly skilled, like Kenna, the group's leader, and Khadija Sefila Griffin, who dances professionally.
I truly feel like it lives up to its name, you know, the Northside Healing Space. I come here alone a lot. It is my sanctuary. And I come and I dance, and I just feel like every time I'm here that this place is protected. It's like a feeling you get here that you don't get in other places. And I think that comes from that intention that Pastor Alika has.
The problem is the place needs a lot of work. Pastor Alika wants not just to fix it up, but to make it beautiful. She plans to recruit healers and artists to work here and to establish a market called Side Hustle, where survivors can sell crafts. She wants Northside Healing Space to be a place of rest, reflection, recovery, and resistance.
The system is white supremacy. You have a system, and it is not about an individual.
Pastor Alika draws a straight line from slavery to survival, sex, and sex trafficking. She says the experience of her own family was the rule, not the exception. Pastor Alika grew up in St. Louis, where she was very close to her grandmother. Her grandmother had four children but lived in the boss's house.
My grandmother helped raise their children, but her children could not live there. And she participated in survival sex on demand, because when you were a maid in that context, most African American maids were sexually violated by the owners of the house. And it was all part of the package.
And the package came directly out of slavery. Pastor Alika's grandmother's grandmother was enslaved.
Part of the huge lesson of slavery is you don't own yourself. You are bartered and traded. And that goes so deep within our collective consciousness and is beat down in you and oppressed in you and beat down. You try to own yourself, but all the symbols eradicate that sense of ownership. And the practice is, in order to get what you need, you sell what you have. There you go.
The women at Northside Healing Space are reclaiming their bodies through dance, African traditions, artistic expression, and the power of community.
We are gathered here today for practicing Voice of Culture drum and dance. We gather every Saturday at 3 o'clock. It's been a while we've been doing Voice of Culture drum and dance. We've been at different locations, like the Capri Theater, but now we're at Northside Healing Space.
As we reported in our special last year, Minnesota is one of the few states that regards commercial sexual exploitation as a public health problem. The state's Safe Harbor law treats sex trafficked youth as victims, not criminals. The health department funds services for young victims in every county. Paula Schaefer runs training programs for Safe Harbor.
There are people to call all over the state. There are regional navigators, Safe Harbor regional navigators. There are specialized community service agencies that are Safe Harbor grantees, and then there's also a shelter, Safe Harbor shelter and housing programs all over the state. So we want people to know that Safe Harbor is a network of services throughout Minnesota.
Safe Harbor, as it stands, provides these services for people until they're 25 years old. Now the health department has joined with the Department of Public Safety and the Department of Human Services to ask the legislator to consider Safe Harbor for All. Safe Harbor for All would consider the safety, health, and dignity of victims and survivors regardless of their age. And it would deal with the historical and social circumstances that contribute to sex trafficking. Meanwhile, service providers and advocates are learning more about the most effective ways to help survivors.
So I just want to say, this day it seems like it's been a long time coming.
And that's Safe Harbor's Paula Schaefer again, addressing service providers from all over the state. The occasion is a three-day Train the Trainer workshop. When it's done, the seven service providers here will be certified to show others how to implement this curriculum, which is called Not a Number. Paula Schaefer says the ripple effect will benefit at least 5,600 young victims.
And you'll be doing your own training or facilitation with kids, and I don't even know if I factored that into the 5,600. Anyhow, that's a lot of kids. That's a lot of kids who are going to experience this life-changing and, I believe, life-saving curriculum.
One of the service providers getting trained is Jenny Miller. We met Jenny earlier in the program.
She was giving young survivors their certificates of completion and telling them that she would always care about them and be available to help them. Jenny was using the Love 146 curriculum. She explains Love 146 has been using that curriculum since 2002.
The CEO and founder of Love 146 had gone on a mission trip to shut down this brothel. And while there, the first day they were scoping the scene out. And so they were being incognito, right? And so he had an opportunity to see that place in action. And so they were given a menu, and in the menu is all the things that they can have these girls do or they can do to these girls sexually. There was a two-way mirror, and so you have girls on one side who can't see, and then you have all the buyers on the other side who can see them. And they're all in the same red dress so that they look similar, and the thing that they have is a number on their chest. And because if you put a name, now you're making them more human, and making them more human makes you more conscious and aware of what you're doing.
Jenny says there was one girl with the number 146. She looked defiant.
And he said every girl in there looked like her soul was gone and that she was broken, that she was sad. Except there was one girl in particular who was sitting almost as if she could see them on the other side of the mirror, even though she can't, making eye contact, saying, I dare you to pick me, I dare you. It made him feel like, this is why I'm here, this is what I wanna do. The mission trip was so focused on the supply, if you will, that he wanted to empower the quote-unquote supply. And so he developed the nonprofit and called it Love 146 after her.
Love 146 was founded a few years after the federal government had passed the Trafficking Victims Protection Act. It didn't take long to figure out that sex traffic was not just an overseas phenomenon.
When you see children locked in spaces and being sexually exploited, that is very obviously wrong, right? We would all agree that that shouldn't happen. And so work in human trafficking started in those spaces, and then people started thinking about and looking at how it manifests in the U.S. a little bit differently, but the exploitation and abuse was actually the same.
That's Kimberly Casey, the Director of U.S. Prevention for Love 146. She's in Minneapolis with a small team of trainers. She's worked with teachers, youth workers, and juvenile court, people in touch with kids from middle-class schools and homeless shelters. Casey says kids are vulnerable because they have needs that must be met. Those needs include food, shelter, and sometimes just affection.
We had one girl who said, I don't do it for the sex. I don't do it for the money. I do it for the 5 minutes afterward where the John holds you. Because in my family, we don't touch each other. I've never been hugged by my parents. And we know that physical touch is something that we as humans need. And so this was the way that she had found to get that need met.
Today, Kim Casey and other Minnesota service providers who use Love 146's curriculum, not a number, are comparing notes about how effective it's been. This is Jenny.
Since I shifted my focus from like, I didn't save her, to she now had language to come into the space and articulate what happened, that we could formulate a safety plan, because that's her words. I need a safety plan. I need to figure something out going forward. And we didn't have to spend that short window of time that we had just identifying what this content is, because the 5 weeks we spent together did. So to me, that's there's more hope in that, as opposed to a young person who didn't go through the curriculum, not understanding what any of these concepts are or where to even go to get help, you know?
The trainers and trainees have questions and suggestions based on experience.
And I think that's something I found to be a hard discussion that I'm having along with risk reduction, is where do we talk about personal responsibility? Because, I mean, it's a lot of what victims do themselves to victim blame other victims. Like,
so the trainers reinforce the fact that victims are never responsible for harm that is done to them. It doesn't matter if they have a few beers or wear tight clothes. It's completely normal for adolescents to take risk.
whether that's sneaking out of the house or partying or even responding to a stranger online. The goal of Not a Number is to get young people to think through risk in advance, make safety plans, and know where to get help.
What I hope this curriculum does for young people in our community is that they don't have to wait until they're 35 years old to learn their worth. You don't know what you don't know, and you are vulnerable when you're not equipped with the tools. And my goal is that young people have access to tools, they have access to supportive adults, and they have access to self-worth as soon as possible.
A few months after the Train to Trainer workshop, we visit Jenny again. She's getting ready to train her own group. 17 people have signed up, including one woman who'd come through Not a Number when she needed help.
She's taking over, and she is incredible and is the next generation that's leading this effort. And next week, she'll be certified to run her own Not a Number groups.
Before we go, we want to introduce you to one more woman. Her name is Artika Roller. She's been working for women her whole life.
Why I'm passionate about this work is that I'm a Black woman that has definitely seen my share of violence against Black women, but also have seen my share of Black women pulling together with Black men and community to make change happen.
We asked Artika Roller the same question we asked everyone you've heard in this program. When it comes to sex trafficking, are things getting better or are they getting worse?
I think the service delivery for youth has gotten better. What feels a little bit worse is in reference to the Black community and how do we heal, how do we address violence against women within our community.
Many of the men and women we spoke with for these programs echoed Artika Roller's reflections. Minnesota's Safe Harbor Law has made resources available to young women who are trafficked. There is a push underway to make those same services available to victims regardless of their age. Native women and Black women are particularly vulnerable because of American history. Colonialism and slavery damage collective and personal identities in ways that continue to this day.
But the system of slavery was built on the exploitation, the rape, and assault of Black women, silencing them because they're not perceived as the perfect victim. And our community also has this history of trying to fix things ourselves, not talking with systems about the problems that we have, and then the strong Black women that we are silenced because we're carrying a lot of our community, our families, whatever, we're carrying that responsibility with us. So we don't have time to sit down and talk about these type of pains. There's a larger picture of what's happening to the Black community at home that a lot of Black women feel responsible for.
So this radio program and the companion program about men are here to support everyone working to end sexual violence and sex trafficking in particular. The time is now to recognize the problem and marshal the resources we need to stop it.
I would not be a social worker if I was not hopeful. So yes, I am hopeful that we can make an impact, that we can foster vehicles of healing for Black women. I am more than hopeful. I am pretty sure that we can do this within our community. We have a rich community with a wealth of expertise and knowledge. We can do this.
This KMOJ special report, Sex Trafficking, Breaking Free from the New Slavery, was made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota.